I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Dean, legal counsel to President Richard Nixon during the Watergate scandal, is our guest this hour, and he has spent the past 4 years cataloging and transcribing all of Nixon's Watergate conversations. 634 conversations had never been transcribed by anyone, nor, as he writes, likely even listened to by anyone outside the National Archives staff that was involved in processing them for public release. He's also pulled over 150,000 pages of related documents from the National Archives. Dean says from beginning to end, Nixon sought to defend himself and his presidency from the political and legal consequences that followed the arrests at the Democratic National Committee on June 17th of 1972. The story is found in Dean's latest book, The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. This really is Richard Nixon's Watergate story. It was John Dean's Senate testimony. Those of you who are getting old now who remember the testimony, as I do, in large measure, Dean's testimony helped lead to the president's resignation 40 years ago, 40 years ago, this coming Saturday, August 9. He's also, Dean, author of Blind Ambition, Broken Government, Conservatives Without Conscience, and Worse Than Watergate. He writes political commentary for Justia.com and testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee in 2006 on President George W. Bush's NSA warrantless wiretap program. We'll be welcoming phone calls for John Dean, as we always do for our guests. And here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we are on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Hello, John Dean.
Hello, Kathleen. We're not getting older. We're getting better.
I guess you are. Anybody who has listened to all these conversations and all those pages and written one whale of a book, 700 pages, you still got it. Your mind's still there, huh?
Well, you know, if going in I'd have known it was going to be as massive as it was, I'm not sure I would have volunteered for it. But once I got in, I said, you know, I've got to take this the whole way.
Mm-hmm. You were transcribing and listening to 634 conversations that we really haven't heard before and haven't been transcribed. Was that just an oversight on the part of historians, or were these tapes not available?
What I did is went in and found nobody had prepared a catalog of all the Watergate conversations, and bless the National Archives, who over the last 4 decades, and I actually dedicate the book to them because I think they're kind of unsung heroes of taking custody and care of this history. I went in and used their subject logs, where they identify. They're really doing it to make sure they get all the national security information and personal information out of the conversations, which is proper. And then they prepare this log, say the name will be, you know, Henry Kissinger, Vietnam negotiations, Paris, Ambassador Bunker, you know, they have different key things that come up in the conversation. I went through and did it manually and plucked out all the Watergate conversations, and that's where I found there are 1,000 conversations. Some are very fleeting. Some are go on for hours upon hours. One is actually an 8-hour conversation.
Wow.
That's considered one. It's him listening to his conversations with me.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, once I got the catalog of all listening of all the conversations, I then looked to see who had transcribed what. The Watergate prosecutors did about 80 transcripts, about 12 of them are excellent. Stanley Cutler did about 320. Stanley's transcripts are wonderful, excepting Stanley had to bring them down to size and edit them. And I often found some of his ellipses, you know, 20 minutes, 30 minutes of information that was important to me to understand the full story. So I redid Stanley's transcripts as well. And then there were these 600-plus conversations that nobody had ever transcribed. I don't think they had even been listened to outside of the National Archives staff.
Mm-hmm.
So that We did all 1,000 conversations.
Remarkable. Well, let's start at the end before we get to the beginning, because what's interesting, there's a conversation that Haldeman is having with Nixon, and Nixon is wanting these tapes that are the subject of the book and the downfall of the president to be destroyed. And somehow, because things don't get done, or tell me what happened, they weren't destroyed. It would have been a whole different story.
It certainly would have been. The best I could, the full, you know, it's a very compressed version of the conversation in the book there. What happened in, when it first comes up, Nixon says that he wants to destroy all the tapes. Haldeman says to him, you know, there are national security conversations that are probably very valuable for China. And that rang the bell with Nixon. And then he said, also, Henry could write a different history than you might, and this would be a solid record of what actually happened. Well, that convinced Nixon that he knew that Kissinger was keeping a lot of notes and what have you of his activities, so that he backed off with that. And he thought about it, and also Haldeman explained that Ehrlichman had a system in his office where he could just hit a switch and it would record the room conversation. And he kind of liked that. So he backed off initially. Then he raises it again and says, well, let's you know, accept the national security stuff. Let's get rid of these tapes. Well, Haldeman never follows up. And as best I can put together what happened is a combination of things. First, Haldeman's not a lawyer. And I think he felt you could selectively take some of those tapes and use them for his own defense.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. You also write, there's so much self-denial going on during so many of these conversations. You write in your book that when Butterfield publicly discloses the existence of the secret recordings, which was this huge moment during the hearings, Nixon says, I've thought about this all night. Maybe Alex Butterfield has done us a favor. These tapes will be exculpatory. I know I never said anything to anybody that could be interpreted as encouragement to cover things up, just the opposite. Oh, my goodness, how could he say that?
Well, particularly what he said earlier when, as you know, he has just been obsessive about the March 21st conversation and the other activities he's been engaged in. So it's just a moment of total self-denial. But I report that sort of thing so one can see how this man was thinking, and not always clearly. One of the reasons I got into this book, Kathleen, was to try to figure out how somebody as savvy as Nixon could let his presidency go down the tube on a bungled burglary.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've concluded is he wasn't as savvy as I thought he was. And it becomes clear when you follow it, when you just day by day watch how he handles this.
Mm-hmm. He was also kind of nasty. I found some of the tapes interesting when he's talking about the rundown of the Supreme Court justices, when he's talking about Colson's law firm, and Colson has some Jews working for him, and that's pretty bad, but boy, sure hope he doesn't get any blacks working for him. I mean, there's a whole thread that's kind of makes you cringe, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, there's some of that from Ehrlichman, which really kind of surprised me. I mean, I had never heard Ehrlichman talk the way the racist rant he gives the president, which I just gave in a very, you know, short form, if you will. But there is a lot of that kind of talk. That's not totally new to us. We knew that Nixon was anti-Semitic. His views on the Supreme Court are kind of interesting for this reason. That tape was one of a conversation with me, and it was released. The prosecutors wanted that tape. They had probable cause to get that. So that surfaced years ago, but that part of the tape was always deleted. And I vaguely remembered what was in there, that he had said, you know, nasty things about the Supreme Court. And it's clear why he insisted that be redacted as he was going to might go to the court.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't want to alienate the court.
What was it? What was the way he described Thurgood Marshall?
A boob.
Oh my, yeah. At what point this whole thing about your writing this definitive report of all that everybody knew, whatever anybody knew in the White House, you were supposed to be the guy who was in charge of this report. And he was saying publicly in press conferences that The FBI has done this amazing report, and of course you, your his legal counsel, has done this report. You've never done any report at all, and yes, at one point you say you were kind of flattered that he was maybe paying attention to you or bringing your name up, so that even though you hadn't done the report, you were being mentioned. Tell us that story.
Yeah, that was it was on August 29th. So that's not too long after the arrest.
Mm-hmm.
And I had actually been called to San Clemente because I was had become sort of the liaison between Mitchell and the reelection committee and Haldeman and Ehrlichman. And I knew the president was going to give a press conference that morning, but I didn't know that he was going to say that that I had conducted an investigation for him. And so I was flabbergasted when I heard this at the news conference. I almost stayed at San Clemente for the news conference. Instead, I had gone up to the hotel because I had work to do, and caught it there. And my first reaction was, I said, "Well, that's certainly a vote of confidence. I haven't even done it, and he's telling the world I've done it. It looks like I'm going to have to be investigating." But nobody wanted me to investigate anything, I'll assure you.
Yeah. And when did you get the feeling, John Dean, that you were going to be left out to hang and dry?
After the March 21st conversation, when I went in and warned him that there was a cancer on his presidency,
mm-hmm.
and he was in trouble, and I tried to convince him to end the cover-up, and he had a 180 degrees different reaction, that the cover-up had to go on, that we at least temporarily had to do it, and he still wants a report. He kept, after he announced this in August of 72, he's still in... March of 73, we go round and round and round on this. You know, what can you write that's honest? Well, it's clear he didn't want an honest report, and there was no way to write an honest report to exonerate anybody. So there were all kinds of problems with it. So it became evident when in one meeting with the president, when Ehrlichman says, in essence, well, John, you've got to write that report, and if it goes wrong, if it's proven wrong, the president can say, "This is all I knew, is what my lawyer told me."
Mm-hmm.
The White House counsel conducted an investigation I didn't conduct, and I did a double take in the meeting, and I said, "Well, John, why don't you write the report?" He didn't volunteer either at that point. But
yeah.
It was at that point I realized that, you know, I was the first one that was expendable. But soon everybody was expendable, including Haldeman and Ehrlichman.
Yeah. It's really interesting to look at the beginning of the book and think that, well, they decided that G. Gordon Liddy is going to take the rap here. It was only Liddy. And then to have this whole cast of characters to read all of the tapes. Oh, no, there's somebody else. There's somebody else. We got Colson. We got Mitchell. We got Magruder. We've got maybe perjury. You just weave this web of, oh, they get in it so deeply after it just starting as, well, it was just going to be Liddy, right? He'll take the rap.
I had two audiences in mind. One were those of us who lived through it,
mm-hmm.
those who knew nothing about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've gotten some feedback from those who knew nothing about it, and they're able to follow the story, and they get it. That's encouraging to me.
Yeah, that is good. It's an important story to remember, isn't it?
It is. We have a tendency as a nation sometimes to forget our history so we can repeat it. And this is one I don't think we should repeat.
Right. Let's take phone calls for you. We'll weave them in and out of our conversation. John Dean is our guest this hour, and his book, Time to Coincide with the 40th Anniversary of the Resignation of President Richard Nixon, August 9th. His book is The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. 800-486-8655 is our number. The email is talk@WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and Twitter @KDunnShow. And we'll start with Scott in La Crosse. Hey, Scott.
Hi, Kathleen. Welcome back.
Thanks, Scott.
Mr. Dean, I think you are probably in a pretty unique position here, having worked for the president and having spent so much time studying all of his papers. And that prompts me to actually want to know the answers to two questions. To the best of my knowledge, nobody has definitively ascertained what the burglars were actually going into the Watergate to accomplish. And so, first of all, I'd like to know, from this vantage point in all your research, why do you think they went in? And the other question is, having once again spent so much time with a virtual Richard Nixon, and having spent some time actually with the man. What's your opinion? Do you think he was truly a venal human being, or do you think he was good, well intentioned, and just went off on the wrong track, or just how do you feel about him now?
Thanks, Scott.
Let me answer those in the order you asked them. The first question you raised is, why did they go in the Watergate? I suspected that would be a question, and so I made that Appendix A. And as I listened to the conversations, I would make an asterisk on the page it occurred on with a footnote to Appendix A, because they talk about this very thing. Why did they, why the White House understood there was a break-in. So you'll find that in Appendix A. In a nutshell, it's a fishing expedition to find financial information that can be used to somehow cause problems for Larry O'Brien, the chairman of the Democratic National Committee. Now, your second question took me about 635 pages narrative and dialogue to lay out. And I really don't offer a lot of my own conclusions in the book. In fact, at one point on one conversation where Nixon's selling an ambassadorship, which caught my breath, I set it up in the meeting. I said, this sounds like a meeting from The Godfather, which it does. My editor, who noted that I had not used that kind of description for most of the meetings and conversations, sent me a note when he's going through the manuscript. Said, "Do you really want to say that?" I didn't. Mm-hmm. But I think the story should speak for itself, and so I try to stay away from those kind of that kind of analysis and what have you. But I think you'll draw your own conclusions from the amount of digging I've done, and we'll never have another primary source like this, and it speaks very strongly for itself.
Mm-hmm. Anything else, Scott?
Well, no, I would just, will be fascinated to read more, and on a larger scale, being one of those eternally young people who happen to have been alive at that time. I don't know how this has happened, but it has. And remembering all of this, watching just with rapt attention. Thank you, sir, for doing what you did. It really probably saved us. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Scott, very much for the call. John Dean is our guest this hour. He spent 4 years listening to the Nixon Watergate tapes. The book is The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Dean is our guest this hour. His book has just been released. He's written several other books and about Watergate. This one is The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. And more welcoming phone calls for him, 800-486-8655. I think that we should probably spend, for those who aren't familiar with the story, there was a wild cast of characters involved in all of this and some incredible stories, the money trail and G. Gordon Liddy and Howard Hunt and Hunt's wife, who was killed in an airplane crash with a lot of cash. And it was bound to be, if it were investigated, some pretty strange things were about to be revealed.
Indeed. As you were talking, too, there's never been a real, true Watergate movie.
Ah.
So, people who like to get their information in that form,
mm-hmm.
This story has never been portrayed. Mm. All the president's men about the Woodward Bernstein tracking the story.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a slice of the story, if you will. Oliver Stone's movie Nixon really is more a biopic than a Watergate story. So there are people who don't know this story, and it obviously starts with a bungled burglary at the Democratic National Committee, and it morphs into the revelation that there is much more going on, that we did today define Watergate as abuse of power for political purposes occurring during the presidency of Richard Nixon. So it involved so much. That's one of the nice feedbacks as an author I'm already getting. The book's only been out about 5 days now, but I had a couple tweets where people, young people, were saying that this is a pretty dramatic story.
And you said at some point that there was a lot of human drama that you found in listening to these tapes that perhaps you didn't know existed before.
I didn't. And, you know, I was, for even my own tapes, which I knew, I remembered the, you know, the gist of the conversations, and then I looked at the transcripts, but hearing them, I had never heard them in all years, other than to be in the basement of the courthouse in the District of Columbia before I testified to verify the voice and what have you for the segments they were doing. But I'd never heard, and I'd never heard, obviously, what had happened before I came into the office or what happened after I left the office. So, yes, there is a lot of drama here and a lot of human nature on display. Mm. It's a very interesting study.
So were you mad at yourself, the yourself you heard?
Actually, the only thing that annoyed myself is a comment where on September 15th, where I kind of play the suck up to the boss and say, isn't that great when he talks about these awful things he wants to do to his enemies. And that's just an immature aide trying to be a suck up, and that was kind of disgusted me.
Yeah.
But other than that, I'm very straight with him. I'm much more candid than his other aides.
Mm-hmm.
I'm surprised that his assessment of me is so high. I didn't know that at the time. He is clearly trying to show off to me at times to convince me that what he does is no worse than other presidents, and he, you know, call me back in to read me something about the Kennedy administration or something like that. But by and large, other than that September 15th meeting, and I got over that very quickly, and I just lay it out. I'm just very factual with him, and we actually deal on a highly professional level as opposed to some of the other aides.
Yeah.
Darkest out of him, like, say, Chuck Colson did.
Right. Although their opinion of you did change a little bit.
Okay,
when
I
you. Yeah, it sure did. Some of those tapes were not flattering later.
No. I become enemy number one when I don't play the game anymore.
Yeah. Let's go to Rich in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Hi. I'm wondering if this is an appropriate inquiry or not, but I'm interested in Mr. Dean's opinion about whether things have gotten better or worse in terms of secrecy in Washington, because I'm reading a review of several books in the New York Review of Books written by Sue Helpern, and in that review of the books, she quotes Edward Snowden as saying that when he, in Geneva, complained that he thought there were ethical lapses in the agency's behavior, he was told not to worry about it, and then he's quoted as saying, this was when I really started seeing how easy it is to divorce power from accountability. And I will listen to Mr. Dean off air, but essentially, I don't think things have gotten better since Watergate and its outcomes. I think they've gotten worse.
Thank you, Rich.
Well, I did a book on that subject. It's called Worse Than Watergate.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about the Bush administration, the Bush II administration, when Dick Cheney had fond memories of his association with the Nixon presidency and wanted to outdo his former mentor and started invoking secrecy like which we had not seen. In post-Watergate, there was much more transparency. I've been surprised at the Obama administration that they seem to have, left a lot of the people in the Bush administration and their policies in the Justice Department and elsewhere in place and are not troubled by it at all. And we had a total reversal with Bush, and particularly through Dick Cheney, of government transparency. So it has gotten worse again. And it is terribly Nixonian. It's unfortunate.
Hmm. Let's go back to the early when Nixon started a cover-up. Would it be fair, John Dean, or not? Am I off the mark when I talk about his wanting to quell the FBI investigation, because they were investigating a lot, they were getting some information. Obviously, it was not flattering to the administration. Was that a beginning of a cover-up, or was it way before that?
The cover-up really starts the weekend of the arrest. It starts over a press release when what happens is the Haldeman is informed in Florida that by Jeb Magruder of the problem, that there, and Magruder has been informed by Ed Liddy that his men have been arrested in the DNC, and it's a disaster. And James McCord, who is the head of security at the Re-Election Committee, is amongst those who have been arrested. They work up a bogus press release, and they agree if, and the White House approves it. Ehrlichman approves it. I happen to be out of the country at the time. And Mitchell approves it, and they put it out. That's where the conspiracy is first formed. The overt acts to obstruct justice start soon thereafter. Mm. Nixon enters the conspiracy clearly the first week after he gets back.
Mm. There's also an awful lot of time with his obsessing, a lot of tapes about Jeb Magruder, a lot of tapes about Mitchell and Colson. I mean, he goes over and over and over this. What if he perjures himself? Did he perjure himself? You know, it's all this, as you say, he could become obsessive, and it's sort of hard to hear some of that because you say, wait a second, you just said the opposite in the tape that you just listened to that was just reported on.
Trust me, I went to the essence on those tapes. And later, when he's really obsessing, I just cut it down to where he's adding new information in the obsession as he talks about it. So I couldn't tax the reader. But a lot of this material is just him just talking over and over and rationalizing and then twisting the facts and what have you. I wanted to give the reader just enough to get a feel of what he was doing and what he was liking in these periods. But it's clear. He vouches for the cover-up, which Haldeman gives him just enough to know the essence of it happening and the fact that they're obstructing justice. He agrees with it because he's initially very concerned that he actually might have... I don't write about this. This you really have to read between the lines, but it becomes apparent. He's initially worried that he might have told Colson to break in the DNC. Hmm. This comes up again later when he learns that Colson was involved indeed in getting Hunt and Liddy approved and getting their action taken down to Mitchell for a final approval. That's a recurring kind of thought he has that, well, maybe I ordered this because he had earlier ordered a break-in into the Brookings Institute.
Right.
Which I happened to learn of and didn't know that came from the president and told them they were insane, and I blew it up. I mean, I put an end to it.
Hmm.
He's very worried about Mitchell's exposure because Haldeman told me probably on a couple conversations, got stuck. I mean, it's one of those facts that sort of thing you would remember. He said, you know, Richard Nixon feels that he's president because of John Mitchell, that Mitchell really kind of gave up his law practice to get Richard Nixon elected. And then he came not wanting to come back to down, not wanting to come to Washington as attorney general. Nixon convinces him to do so. He was not a good attorney general. Turned out to be a disastrous
mm-hmm.
And now he's worried, and Nixon knows that. And now he's worried about the fact that he may go to jail for approving or not minding the store.
Mm-hmm.
And he becomes very concerned about that, too.
It consumes so much time when there was so much else going on in the world, wasn't there, John?
There was, indeed. He was trying to bring to conclusion his effort to get a peace in Vietnam. And Kissinger is conducting his secret negotiations. It's a little bit deceptive to read the book and think the early parts one and two in particular, that's all he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
His calendar is actually fairly busy. And to introduce the characters and their style of speaking and what have you, I open those conversations up a little bit more than I do, and I have to constantly compress them. The Parts 1, 2, and 3 represent a little over 300 conversations. Part 4 is over 600 conversations. So you can see the difference.
Right.
And part 4 is a little bigger, too.
Yeah. Richard in Madison, hi.
Hi. I have a question. Why was Richard Nixon not impeached rather than permitted to resign?
He was not impeached because he did resign. He theoretically could have been impeached after he resigned. There's some memos around the House Impeachment Committee has made its records pretty difficult to get a hold of. But I know from knowing the Democratic Council of that committee that they looked at that issue and whether they had an obligation to continue with impeachment even though he had resigned. And theoretically, they could have. They decided as a collective political body not to do so, that it would look like they were grinding down on this man. Because the only outcome would have been, if they had done so, would have been to send it to the Senate, and the Senate to then, the only issue at trial would have been to bar him from future office. Well, Nixon wasn't about to run for anything, so
right.
it got absurd at some point if you push it all the way out.
Thank you, Richard. Rick in Elkhart Lake, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It's an honor to talk to Mr. Dean. I can't believe I'm talking to him. Mr. Dean, I watched with rapt attention back to the Watergate hearings, and to me it showed, I thought it was kind of hopeful in that it showed democracy really working in that no one's above the law. And your comments, you wrote the book, I thought you said to hope that this kind of thing wouldn't happen again. But when I saw with the Reagan administration, the Iran-Contra, it seemed to me what happened was they just got better at covering things up. What they learned from Watergate was how to cover it up better. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, you know, a lot of people in Washington I've talked to over the years, no less than Ben Bradley, the former editor of the Washington Post, and we were talking about this on the 40th anniversary of the break-in. The Washington Post invited some people to come to Washington, and they rented the top floor of the office building, which I'd never been in before.
Oh.
And then afterwards, Ben had a small gathering, and he and I were talking that night, and he was saying that he thought, in many ways, that Iran-Contra was much worse than Watergate. It had much more serious implications than a bungled burglary and these campaign antics that were so much a part of the Nixon administration. So you're right. It didn't end them. But if we forget totally our history, the cautionary aspect of it is gone. And while the Iran-Contra was, in essence, a cover-up, it got pretty well peeled open. And the man who put the end to it was actually George Bush. Bush won, who pardoned everybody who hadn't gotten off otherwise. And I've often wondered, Nixon could have pardoned everybody before he left. And he clearly, while it's not in my book or in the tapes, I'm convinced he cracked a deal with Haldeman that he would falsely testify, knowing the high risk he was taking, that during the March 21st conversation, that Nixon had not said when this issue of money coming up, and I'd said, well, it cost $1 million, and Nixon said, I know where we can get that.
Mm-hmm.
That the next thing he said, but that would be wrong. Well, he never said that. In the review of the book for the Wall Street Journal, I noticed Frank Gannon, who is something of a Nixon toady, even though he has a PhD and can think clearly, I hope. He claimed, somehow I reported the March 21st conversation and failed to put in the fact that Nixon said, but that would be wrong. Well, Haldeman went to jail on claiming that was in that conversation. But anyways,
oh, that's fascinating. Learn. Yeah, they don't. I want to talk about lying and telling the truth. There's a part here where you talk about offenses such as conspiracy and obstruction of justice are not bright line cries that are immediately and easily discernible to those who are not experienced in criminal law. A striking number of lawyers, you write, found themselves on the wrong side of the law during Watergate, and almost all of them did so out of ignorance of criminal law. And yet, John, isn't there a pretty stark difference between don't we know when we're lying and don't we know when we're telling the truth?
I make the point that perjury is clear. That's one that we learn from the time we're children.
Yeah.
Which is interesting that Nixon, who knew the law of perjury well, is actively engaged in suborning.
Yes.
That was a very troublesome one. But the obstruction of justice does not take perjury to obstruct justice. There are all kinds of things you can do that will get you into a conspiracy to obstruct justice.
Mm-hmm. But as you go on to say, to keep a cover-up contained without lying to investigators becomes almost impossible as time goes on. You can't keep track of everything.
That's true. You know, what is interesting, you can put out a false press release and be obstructing justice.
Hmm.
And you don't have any obligation to be truthful in your press release. And these are the very tricky areas in the campaign law. You get some of these difficulties, you know, the difference between a contribution and a bribe. It's the distinction could be as fine as a hair on a frog's back.
We welcome our phone calls in a moment. John Dean is our guest this hour. This week would have been on Saturday the 40th anniversary of the resignation of Richard Nixon. And the book is timed to coincide with that momentous historical event. John's book, latest one, is The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Dean is our guest. His book is The Nixon Defense. He spent 4 years listening to and transcribing all of Nixon's Watergate conversations. The goal of the book is to sift through and report the entire recorded archive of Nixon's Watergate conversations. Big job. Let's go to Bill in New Berlin. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you, Bill?
Geez, I just fell down and hit my head.
Oh, my God. Bill, are you okay?
I lived through the Nixon era.
Yeah?
And I was a Nixon fan, but I'm not getting a sense from Mr. Dean about what his opinion is of whether or not Nixon should have resigned or whether he would have been found guilty by a Senate impeachment committee. And I'd like to know his opinion about that.
Okay.
I think it's overwhelmingly clear that he would have been, one, he would have been impeached by the House, and secondly, he would have been found guilty by the Senate.
Hmm.
And that's why he left. He knew he didn't have the votes. He had hoped the Southern Democrats, who will now be Republicans, would support him and stay with him. But if you recall, by the time he resigned, 80% of America thought he did the right thing. Not many issues 80% of Americans agree upon anything anymore. So it makes it kind of it really became very bipartisan in the decision that he did the right thing. And that happened, of course, after the last tape came out that showed his defense, that he claimed that he knew nothing about the Watergate until I had told him on March 21st, was a total fraud. And it was only one set of conversations from the June 23rd, but I'm telling you there are dozens of conversations.
Mm-hmm.
That the gamble he took with that defense was remarkable.
Mm-hmm. And you can read all the conversations in the book. I hope your head's okay, Bill. Thank you very much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. There aren't any tapes on this, but I was interested in, I mean, Nixon won re-election by this huge landslide, you know, unbelievable landslide, and yet he felt that he had to go to these great extremes to to bug, you know, what was going on with the Democrats, to find out whatever he could, and yet he was assured of reelection. And yet, as you write, he didn't do anything to campaign for other Republican congressional people who were running. And I'm wondering why he didn't do that, if that could have changed Watergate, if he had had, you know, more support in the House, in the Senate.
That was certainly one of the thoughts of a lot of people on the staff, that, that had he campaigned and had some coattails, a combination, while the Republicans wouldn't have won control, there would have been a sort of a philosophical conservative control of the House, and impeachment would have been much less likely. But Nixon chose not to. Part of his Southern strategy at that point was to try to divide Democrats. So he stayed away from Republicans, certainly in the South, because he preferred often Southern conservative Democrats who had supported him in the war and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the North, he does some campaigning, but he runs a Rose Garden campaign where he is really not out on the trail and beating the bush. Rather, he's doing it from the White House and letting surrogates do it, and that does nothing for a coattail effect for a president. So in the end, you know, I think that's one of the reasons he explains that he was so morose the night after he won re-election, because he knew he'd now achieved his highest goal, but he had this terrible shadow of Watergate. And had he thought that through, he might have done more to win hearts and minds of members of Congress, so he wouldn't have had that problem. But he was—he just felt somewhat immune from all these technical legal issues that were surrounding Watergate.
What did he say to you when you put it quite dramatically in that March 21st conversation? I think there's no doubt about the seriousness of the problem we've got. We have a cancer within, close to the presidency, that's growing. What did he say to you?
Well, he didn't have to say. His body language spoke.
Oh.
And what's interesting, you can hear so much on these tapes. You can hear him drag a coffee cup. The microphones are drilled right into the wood of the desk.
Oh.
They pop out. There are five microphones in that desk in the Oval Office. If he drags a coffee cup across his desk, it sounds like a train going through the Oval Office.
Huh.
But he often had his feet up on the desk and his chair tilted back, and I always wondered if he could tip and fall on the floor, like poor Bill had just hit his head.
Right, right.
But that morning, his feet were propped up there, and I decided to use that metaphor. Actually, we had a little chat first about Pat Gray before that part of the conversation. I said, I need to make sure I get his full attention. And that's when I used that analogy there's a cancer on his presidency, and he slowly, you can barely hear it, but he slowly pulls his feet down, and I realize I've got his full attention during that conversation. In fact, he'll stand up once during that conversation, which was very seldom, because he's thinking, he's nervous, he's concerned, and he writes that night in his diary, which I quote in the book. Nothing really happened today except Dean came in and let all hang out with that cancer talk he gave me and so. So I got through to him and registered.
Mm-hmm. Stan in Madison. Hi, Stan.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Isn't it true that in a six-month period after the Watergate break-in, and prior to the election of 72, that there was actually some discussion in, I believe, a congressional committee about the Watergate break-in, and for some reason it was not pursued. Can you fill in some of the details of that?
Sure. I think you're referring to the fact whether the House was considering an investigation of the Watergate break-in. And it was Wright Patman's Committee on Banking and Currency, and their hook to get into it was the fact that money had appeared in the account of one of the burglars, and the fact they when they were arrested, they had all these new $100 bills stuffed in their pockets, and then moreover in their room in the Watergate. So they had a very loose hook, but at least they, you know, followed the money kind of approach to it, and we're going to investigate it. What happens is was that a combination of Republicans and Southern Democrats, at the request of the White House, and indeed no less than Jerry Ford, giving his full weight to it, killed that investigation. They voted to not have any subpoenas or let the chairman go forward with the investigation. So it never got off the ground. Mm,
interesting. Thanks, Doug. I mean, Stan. We go to Doug now in Lake Mills. Hi, Doug.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I guess what I'd like to know is what's your long-term assessment of the consequences of the Watergate crisis? And also, secondly, what's your assessment of Nixon's place in the, as a president when you compare him to other people?
Well, I can let's take the Nixon assessment first, because I can deal with that fairly quickly. I think Nixon, because of Watergate, will always rank fairly lowly. There have been some efforts at revisionism that are just so bogus they're not working. That was another fact. Reason I thought we ought to get the truth out as to what indeed happened in that Oval Office. This report is not going to help him historically, but it's an honest report of what happened. So that'll be the burden his presidency will always carry. As far as the long-term assessment of Watergate, most of the Watergate reforms have come and gone. Campaign finance was a major post-Watergate reform. Well, the Supreme Court, for its own reasons in reading the First Amendment, in cases like Buckley versus Viejo, right down to Citizens United, has pretty much eviscerated all the post-Watergate campaign reform laws. And I have material in the book where Nixon himself acknowledges the fact that they had so much money and easy cash over at the reelection committee, explains why they're doing foolish and crazy things like breaking into the DNC and doing other things that are just, if you have a tight budget, you don't do those kinds of things. So I'm sure Nixon would be one of the first to tell you that there are problems with all the money that's rolling around in campaigns right now. Another thing that came out, the number one recommendation of the Senate Watergate Committee was the creation of an independent counsel law. Well, that law has now sunset because both Democrats and Republicans were sufficiently damaged by it that they let it retire. So it's no longer on the books. And I don't think there's a great movement to bring back that statute. You always have an attorney general who can appoint a special counsel or an independent investigator to a degree, but that takes a lot of public pressure. So we don't have that law anymore. Investigative journalism, which became the vogue after Watergate,
right.
It's pretty much come and gone.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's too expensive for most news organizations. We have the Internet, that's influenced journalism. Corporate ownership has changed. The bottom line attitude towards investigative reporting, which doesn't necessarily pay off and can actually annoy major corporations that are important customers. So that's gone. I'll tell you without going through the whole litany, one of the things that has stayed, which actually came right out of my testimony, is so many lawyers got across the line. I was asked by Herman Talmadge of Georgia. He said, why did you put asterisk beside all these names I had on this one document that he spotted? And I said, I couldn't figure out how in God's name so many lawyers got on the wrong side of the law. Well, the American Bar Association noted that, and soon I had a call from a friend who had been asked by the ABA to look at their recently adopted code and refashion it with some real-world ethics, laws, and requirements, which they did. Fellow by the name of Bob Kutak, and he asked me to come out to Nebraska, where he had his commission off and had its meetings, and to talk to his staff and what have you, and sort of bounce ideas. And he was talking to hundreds of people. The House of Delegates of the American bar adopted most of them. Not until Enron did they adopt them all. But I can tell you one thing that has prevailed is the requirement of ethical training of lawyers.
Well, that's something. John Dean, we're out of time. It's been a true pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for being with us and for doing this wonderful work that adds to our historical record in such an important way. Thank you.
Thank you.
John Dean, our guest. The book is The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. John Dean, for those of you who don't remember the time, was legal counsel to President Nixon during the Watergate scandal. The book is well worth reading if you don't know very much about it, because you'll know a whole lot about it as a result of reading this book. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing the hour. Thanks to K.P. as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. And thank you for listening.